We're reading from the introduction, Bhagavad Gita, the bottom of page 4, and I think all of page 5. This is the last paragraph on the bottom of page 4. How Arjuna accepted the Bhagavad Gita should be noted. His manner of acceptance is given in the 10th chapter, text 12 through 14. Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram Paramam Bhavam, Purusham Shashvatam Divyam, Aridevam Ajam Vibhum. Ahustvam rishaya sarve devashir naradastuta asita devalo vyasa swayam chaiva bravishime sarvameta ritam manye yamam varasike shava nahite bhagavan vyaktim virudeva nadanavaha. Arjuna said, "You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the ultimate abode, the purest, the absolute truth. You are the eternal, transcendental, original person, the unborn, the greatest. All the great sages such as Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyasa confirm this truth about you. And now you yourself are declaring it to me. O Krishna, I totally accept as truth all that you have told me. Neither the demigods nor the demons, O Lord, can understand your personality." After hearing Bhagavad Gita from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Arjuna accepted Krishna as Param Brahma, the Supreme Brahman. Every living being is Brahman, but the Supreme Living Being or the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the Supreme Brahman. Param Dhamma means that he is the supreme rest or abode of everything. Pavitra means that he is pure, untainted by material contamination. Purusham means that he is the supreme enjoyer. Sashvatam, eternal, Divyam, transcendental, Adidevam, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ajam, the unborn, and Vibhum, the greatest. Now, one may think that because Krishna was the friend of Arjuna, Arjuna was telling him all this by the way of flattery. But Arjuna, just to drive out this kind of doubt from the minds of the readers of Bhagavad Gita, substantiates these praises in the next verse when he says that Krishna is accepted as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, not only by himself, but also by authorities like Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyasadeva. These are great personalities who distribute the Vedic knowledge as it is accepted by all acharyas. Therefore, Arjuna tells Krishna that he accepts whatever he says to be completely perfect. Sarvam etan ritam manye. Quote, "I accept everything you say to be true." Arjuna also says, Arjuna also says that the personality of the Lord is very difficult to understand and that he cannot be known even by the great demigods. This means that the Lord cannot even be known by personalities greater than human beings. So how can a human being understand Lord Krishna without becoming his devotee? And I think that's all I'm supposed to read. The problem is the next paragraph continues with the thought of the last paragraph. Will I get chastised if I...
So
go one more paragraph? That's okay. So, therefore, even if I get chastised, I will read it anyway. Parvati and I are old friends, so she can chastise me if she likes. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita should be taken up in a spirit of devotion. One should not think that he is equal to Krishna, nor should he think that Krishna is an ordinary personality or even a very great personality. Lord Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead. So, according to the statements of Bhagavad Gita, or the statements of Arjuna, the person who is trying to understand the Bhagavad Gita, we should at least theoretically accept... let me read that again. So according to the statements of the Bhagavad Gita or the statements of Arjuna, the person who is trying to understand the Bhagavad Gita... Wait a minute. Does that make sense? The person trying to understand the Bhagavad Gita... Oh, okay. According to the statements of Arjuna, the person who's trying to understand the Bhagavad Gita, we should at least theoretically accept Sri Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And with that submissive spirit, we can understand the Bhagavad Gita. Unless one reads the Bhagavad Gita in a submissive spirit, it is very difficult to understand Bhagavad Gita because it is a great mystery. There was once there was a book, and the title of the book is In Search of the Obvious. And the premise of the book is that the obvious slips by everybody. They don't see the obvious, and they look for something complicated. And the complicated is not true, but people feel if it's true, it must be complicated. And so if you feel that if it's true, it must be complicated, then you may miss the simple, obvious truth simply because it's simple and obvious, and therefore you think if it's simple and obvious, it must not be... That couldn't be it because it's too simple. I get it. I understand it. So that couldn't be the deep, hidden, mysterious, esoteric meaning. It's too simple. So then we look for some deep, esoteric meaning that's complicated and we end up missing the simple meaning. So one time, Prabhupada said that Krishna consciousness is so simple you can miss it. It's like it's spiritual life and spiritual knowledge is obvious and so simple and obvious that if you're looking for something mystical, you might not get it. It might just pass you by. So, anyway. If you read Bhagavad Gita, you will see that Bhagavad Gita is spoken by Lord Krishna. And the Sanskrit is Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. It doesn't say Krishna said, it says Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. So, for those of you who are Indian, you know Bhagavan means God. It's the name of God. One who has everything, all opulence, all beauty, wealth, strength, fame, knowledge. That's God. So, Bhagavan. So, why didn't the author say Krishna said? Why did he say Bhagavan said? Simple answer, right? Because Krishna is Bhagavan. And he wanted to establish that Krishna is Bhagavan. He didn't say Bhagavan Krishna said to Bhagavan Arjuna. Did he? It was never there. Now some people say we're all God. I'm God, you're God. Okay. But the author didn't say Bhagavan Krishna said to Bhagavan Arjuna. He said Bhagavan Sri Krishna said, Bhagavan Sri Krishna Uvacha, he said, Bhagavan, God said. So that's pretty simple. It's straightforward, right? Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. It's right there. If you know Sanskrit, you can understand. If you know Hindi, you can understand. Right? Pretty simple. Pretty straightforward. And so then someone reads Bhagavad Gita and thinks, oh, Krishna's an ordinary person. Like, how did you miss that? Or Krishna says, I'm a person. and then somebody reads Bhagavad Gita and says Krishna is not a person. So we can have a billboard and we can put it on all the highways in India, and we can have the verse which says, Krishna says, I am the Supreme Person, and we can say, what part of I am the Supreme Person don't you understand? Is it too simple? Because so many people have commented that Krishna is just a manifestation of something higher. And he never said that. So isn't that interesting? It's so simple you can miss it. And people miss it. And they miss it by a long shot. Actually, he's not God, we're God. What verse is that? I didn't read that verse. I read Bhagavad Gita, but I missed that verse. Can you show me where that verse is? And there isn't a verse. Or maybe they quote a verse, but it doesn't say that, and they try to make it say that. Right? So that's, you understand what I'm saying? The nature is to complicate things. It's like, the straightforward meaning is not mystical enough, or it's not esoteric enough, it's too simple, we have to create some new meaning. That's one problem. Then another problem is, as Srila Prabhupada said, that if I accept the direct meaning of Bhagavad Gita and I'm a writer, then I don't get any credit, because it's the same as everyone else said. So my Bhagavad Gita isn't special. So I have to say something different, then it'll be special. So let me come up with something new and different. Because as we know, if it's new and different, it's better, right? No, it isn't, but that's the paradigm. If it's new, it's better, right? We were buying a washing machine in America, and we were thinking, maybe we'll get a used one. And the person said, well, if you buy the ones like 20 years old, they're much better than the new ones, because they made them better 20 years ago. So new is not always better. Right? Sometimes new is worse. In America. Yeah, better. Yeah. In England, everything old in England was made better. The Prabhupada makes another point, which is interesting. If you want to understand someone who is very great, someone who is very learned, very talented, and you're not very smart, and you're not very great, and you're not very learned, like, you know, you come from a village, and you never went to school for more than a few years, and you know how to farm very well, but you really don't know how to live in a city, and you don't understand business and computers and like that. And someone's the CEO of some big company. It's kind of hard for you to understand him, isn't it? Because you don't have that experience. So Prabhupada's making a point that to understand God, you have to be somewhat godly, or you won't understand him. Today we were taking a walk, and we walked by a tree. And years ago, Jamuna used to be on the path. And Krishna did something very naughty on this tree. It's called Chira. Chira, Chira. Chira means thief, or to steal. Krishna stole some people's clothes. We won't mention whose for now, but Krishna stole some people's clothes. Actually, they were girls' clothes. That's really difficult to understand, isn't it? If you're just trying to begin spiritual life, and you hear something like this, it's very difficult to understand. You're saying this person is God, and he stole some young girl's clothes, and he put the clothes in the tree, and said, if you want the clothes, you have to come and get them from me, come out of the water. Wait a minute. This doesn't make any sense. Does it? Especially if we did that, we'd be arrested. Right? Then. So I was telling the devotees, I was saying that Krishna does things we should not do. And then you might think, well, why would he do that? That doesn't make sense either, does it? You know? If you want people to follow you, you would do what you want them to do, not what you don't want them to do. And Krishna does what he doesn't want us to do. Isn't that interesting? Not everything, but some things he does. Right? We also know that Krishna sometimes dances with other people's wives. And he tells us, only dance with your wife, not other people's wives. And some people think, well, you dance with other women, other men's wives, why can't I? I should follow you, you're the example. No. You won't understand unless you understand his nature, why he does that. When Krishna does that, there's a message. What's the message? Don't do it. I can do it. These other men's wives, they're not actually other men's wives. They're my wives. Every woman is my wife. You know that story? Where this man had heard this story that Krishna is dancing with other men's wives. And he was complaining. He said, how can this be God? This doesn't make sense. And Prabhupada said, your wife is Krishna's wife. So he was accusing, this man was accusing that Krishna is stealing the wives of other men. And he said, no, you've stolen one wife from Krishna. Your wife is his. It's not that he's stolen, you've stolen. Who would think like that, right? Every wife, every woman is Krishna's, right? So if Krishna dances with other men's wives, what is he saying? He's saying, I can do that because ultimately they're my wives. They all belong to me. You cannot do that. There's a difference between me and you. If you try to do this, you will suffer. But if I do this and you hear about me doing this, you will become purified of the desire to do it. Ladies, I hate to break the news to you, but every man likes to enjoy with many women, even your husband. But if he's a good husband, he won't. But it doesn't mean he doesn't want to. That desire is there in the heart of every man. One woman is not enough. In the olden days, men had many wives, right? If they could afford it. And when it was allowed, men did it because they have that tendency. Many men have that tendency. It's illegal, but when it wasn't illegal, they were allowed to do it because they had that tendency. Right? And Krishna does that, but he does it to teach us that you don't do that. You don't dance with other men's wives. You don't steal girls' clothes. But the most amazing thing about it, and which is difficult to understand for ordinary people, is that by hearing about Krishna doing that, we lose our desire to do that. We become purified of the desire to do that. Why? Well, Prabhupada said here in the purport, the nature of Krishna, he's the supreme enjoyer. What does that mean? Supreme enjoyer. That's an interesting word, isn't it? Parampurusha. You know, like sometimes you might go to the house of a very wealthy person and he's designed this house in such a way there's no discomfort, you know. Everything's perfect. The light is in the right place, the temperature, the view, the sun rises, it comes through this window sits in this chair and he gets the sun, and like everything is perfect, right? He's got a Maserati, he's got a Porsche, he's got the right chair, the massage chair, and you know, he's got everything, the best speaker system. And what will you say? You say, this man knows how to enjoy. right? He really knows how to enjoy. Precision enjoyment. He's figured out every detail of enjoyment. Beautiful kitchen, beautiful this. But what did it take for that man to get that house built? How much work did it take? A lot, yes? It took a lot of work to get the money, and then a lot of work and blood, sweat, and tears to design it, and then a lot of work and blood, sweat, and tears to execute it. And a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to maintain it. Yes? All right. So when we say Krishna's the supreme enjoyer, he doesn't sweat. He doesn't suffer before he enjoys. Before we enjoy, we have to undergo some suffering, some work, right? Yes? For example, if you make an equation of enjoyment, you have to add in the before, the middle, and the end. What did it take you to get the enjoyment? How much time and how much enjoyment did you get it? And what's the ramification of that enjoyment? What is the maintenance of it? What were the byproducts of it? Did anybody get hurt by that enjoyment? Do you have to make amends and so forth? So for all of us in this world, we have to factor in those three things in our enjoyment. Oh, I went on a vacation. It was very enjoyable. What did it take you to go on a vacation? Well, I had to work for 11 and a half months. Then they gave me 2 weeks. And now I finally had a little extra money so I could go on the vacation. And I went on vacation, and for those 2 weeks, fantastic. I didn't have to cook, I didn't have to do laundry, I just lay on the beach. And it was a great, great time. And then you go back to work. And that is like one of the hardest things to do, is to go back to work after vacation, isn't it? So you had great time, you had a hard time, you had to work, make the money, then you had a great time, and then now you're lamenting that the time's up, right? So if you add it all up, it's not as good as it looks, does it? I mean, those were 2 good weeks, but what you had to do before and what you have to do after, you have to add that into the equation. So when it's said that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, he's not like that. He doesn't have to undergo any trouble for his enjoyment. He enjoys. Gentlemen, I could guarantee you, if you go to the Jamuna and steal all the ladies' saris and sit in a tree and say, come, and I'll give you the clothes, you're going to get in big trouble. I can guarantee you that. It might be fun for a few minutes, but after that, you're going to be in a van on your way to the police station. And I don't know how long you're going to be in jail, but you'll be in jail. And I don't know if those women's husbands are going to come looking after you when you get out of jail, but probably they will. And it's not going to be fun, right? You agree? So that's what Krishna's teaching. Krishna's teaching, I know how to enjoy it. I can do it. I know how to make this work. And if you understand that about me, then you can enjoy through me as I enjoy. That will bring you enjoyment also. When you hear about my enjoyment, you will also enjoy. Right? You enjoy hearing about Krishna more than doing it yourself? So we were saying Krishna was dancing with these wives, other men's wives. And when a person who doesn't understand those pastimes hears about this, what does the person think? What do they think? We'll ask this question to the men. Men, what do you think? If you're not Krishna conscious, what do you think?
They are enjoying actually, subtly. They put themselves in the position of the enjoyer.
So, all right, let's. He said they put them in the position of enjoyer. That means, let's go back a little bit. When a devotee hears the pastime, they see that these ladies are dancing with Krishna, and the devotee thinks, these ladies are so fortunate, yes, to dance with Krishna. It would be wonderful if I could dance with Krishna. When a non-devotee hears it, especially a man, he thinks, this is a wonderful pastime. It would be so wonderful if I could be in the center with all these ladies. Yes? That's the difference. Yes. So that's the meaning of supreme enjoyer. Only Krishna could enjoy that. Nobody else could enjoy it. And men do try to enjoy it. It doesn't work. Not the way Krishna enjoys. And if we allow Krishna to enjoy, we become happy. And we become purified of our desire to enjoy. Simple. Yes? So it depends how you hear the pastime. But anyway, supreme enjoyer. Another meaning or another aspect of supreme enjoyer, which is being told here, is that, well, the same idea. I'll give you an example. I was contemplating doing a course for people in general on happiness, how to be happy. And I've actually taught it at least three times that I can remember. Maybe four times, yeah. And every time I teach it, I'm not entirely satisfied. Because every time I teach it, I think that the essence of the problem in becoming happy is the desire to be happy. That's the problem. So if I teach a course on how to be happy, then I'm teaching people how to be happy. And how to be happy means what? I'm thinking about me, how to be happy. And that's the reason I'm not happy. So how can I teach you a course on 12 steps to be happy when that would therefore make you very self-centered? Because you're thinking how to be happy. And I always come back to this conclusion that if you have a desire to be happy, that's the very reason you're not happy. And when that desire is no longer there, on that day, you'll be happy. That's the first day in your life, you'll always be happy. Otherwise, happiness is like, it's a moment in time, isn't it? We went to the movie. It was really good. That was a moment in time. Now the movie's over. Now what do? Go back down to where we started before the movie. I'm not happy. I need something. Well, we could go out to dinner. Okay. Another moment in time. An hour. Hopefully you don't get any fights with your family or anything. It's a good hour. And then now what do? So it's a moment in time. Right? So that day, you come to a point where you have no desire to be happy, that'll be the happiest day in your life. Of course, it may take your whole life to get to that that consciousness. That'll be the happiest day in your life. So, a devotee wants to see Krishna happy. Yes? That's it. That's their happiness. That's all. And so, if he's the supreme enjoyer, what does that mean? It means he knows how to enjoy. I don't. I know how to enjoy a little bit, but he knows how to enjoy completely. And if I facilitate his enjoyment, then I can really enjoy. And if I try to enjoy, I can't. I can only get a moment in time. A little bit here and a little bit there. But if I try to help him enjoy, I can be happy all the time. Now, I had another thought about this course on happiness. And because the reason I was thinking about teaching about happiness is that so many people teach about it. There's books on it. A lot of the Buddhist teachers are teaching about happiness. And happiness is something which is considered, which is coveted. It's something everybody wants, isn't it? So it's, you teach about how to be happy, it's a popular topic. Then I started thinking about it, and I was thinking that for someone who is experiencing spiritual bliss or ananda, happiness is nothing. That's really insignificant. It's not even something that rates as something really valuable. Isn't it? Because what is happiness? It's a situation which provides a moment in time to get some pleasure and some relief from your normal state of consciousness. Maybe the best example would be go into the pub, the bar. What do you call it in India? The bar? Pub? Pub is a British word. In America we have bars. In England you have pubs. So you go into a pub, and what happens after a while? You dull your consciousness enough that you forget all your suffering. And that's called happiness. Right? Now, you might say, I don't drink. Okay, you don't drink, but you do something to intoxicate yourself. A sport, could be sex, a movie, something to forget your life and your consciousness so that you can be happy for a moment in time. Yes? Do you feel happy on Friday night? Yes. Why do I feel happy? Because I don't have to go to work tomorrow. Nothing positive at all. Just the misery won't be there tomorrow. Then you get a call and your boss says you have to come tomorrow. The misery is there. Yes? You lost your moment in time. It's gone. So I think the fact that everyone's looking for happiness has these two flaws. One, it's selfish, and selfishness doesn't produce happiness. And two, compared to spiritual bliss, material happiness is nothing. It's not even something we would strive for. Isn't that interesting? The thing that everyone in this world is striving for, the spiritualist isn't even looking for. It doesn't register in his life as anything valuable. Isn't that interesting? You know, someone says, I want to be happy. And we would say, why would you want to be happy when you can have ananda? You can have bliss. Why would you want to be happy? Bliss is so much beyond happiness. Happiness is like, what's the use of that? It's going to go away in a second, right? You know, the Buddhists talk about being present because it's only in the present moment that you can be happy. But still, although that's true, and they teach don't look to the future because you're always thinking you'll be happy in the future and you lose the moment, right now you could be happy, just appreciate the moment, which is true. But what's the motive behind it? The motive is me be happy. So the whole consciousness is me be happy. And if you're happy, people think, yes, you've hit it. You've hit the jackpot. You're happy, isn't it? I've hit the jackpot. I've hit the top of the mountain. I'm happy. And for a spiritualist, happy? That's like insignificant. That's nothing. So what's the idea? Krishna's the supreme enjoyer, and you serve him? You can actually enjoy when you serve his lila, but you'll suffer if you try to imitate his lila. Yes? Now, one more point Prabhupada made. Prabhupada says... He uses the word submissive. You know what the word submissive is? What does submissive mean?
Obedient.
Yeah, more like obedient. Surrender, yeah, obedient. Not challenging. Could say it means humble. So Prabhupada's saying here, in this context, submissive would mean to accept what Krishna is saying in the Bhagavad Gita, at least in theory, if not in fact, at least in theory, because The only way to understand Bhagavad Gita ultimately is if Krishna gives you some mercy and some intelligence to understand it. And if we're not submissive, we don't get it. I might read Bhagavad Gita and think, well, I don't know if this is true. I don't know if this is right. I don't know if Krishna exists. But Krishna is the one who is going to give you the intelligence to understand it. So if you challenge him, then how will you understand if you're challenging the person who spoke it? It's like people, sometimes they challenge the Gita. Well, I don't know, Krishna this, Krishna that. And so I tell them, I said, your teacher says something, do you stand up and say, I don't know. How do you know? Could be this, could be that. You don't do that. I said, why? You don't do that anywhere, and then you come to Bhagavad Gita and you do that, and you start doing it there. It doesn't make sense. Does it? How do you know? One time the devotees were walking with Prabhupada, and so they were talking about the creation of the universe. And of course the devotees said, Prabhupada, the scientists say, etc., etc. Some theory, some idea, latest theory. There was an explosion from that explosion. There was a single-cell amoeba. From that single-cell amoeba formed more complex living beings until today. It just kept getting more complex. And look at us. We're the end product of evolution. And it just happened by accident. Nobody planned it. It just, it's how it is. And Prabhupada would say, of course, the Vedas explain it differently. It was intelligently designed. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't by chance. It was all planned out. And it's all being controlled according to a blueprint. And everything's set up and it's being executed perfectly. It's all designed. Srila Prabhupada, but the scientists, they don't believe that. And so they would, the devotees would explain what the scientists believe, give the theory and so forth. And they say, but Prabhupada, they say, you know, you have faith in God. You know, you can't see him. So it's just faith. And Prabhupada would say, were you there at the beginning of creation? You're telling me about the beginning of creation. Were you there? Did you see it? You want me to believe? You want me to believe your theory? Number one, you weren't there. You can't demonstrate that an explosion creates order. You can't demonstrate that from a single cell amoeba you get a complex being as intelligent as a human. And you want me to believe that? And you're saying that God is God? If I believe in God, I have faith. And if I believe in you, it's science, and science means fact. Right? So then Prabhupada was pointing out that you have religious teachings, you have religious scriptures, you have Vedas and so forth, and they're teaching things which you're not going to be able, in every case, to experiment with, to prove. They're teaching about things that are beyond what you can perceive. It's mystical, it's transcendental. So then he said, you have two choices. You have the material explanation or the scientific explanation of the creation of the world and how it's run, or you have the sacred, spiritual agent. So choose which one. It's not that one is faith and one isn't. It's not that one is science and one isn't. Ultimately, they're both faith because you don't know. Okay. Does God exist? Maybe. We don't know. Have you seen him? No. But we believe in him. Okay, that's faith. We agree. That's faith. The world came from a big bang. Have you seen it? Did you see it happen? Did you duplicate it? No, no, no. Okay, agree that it's faith. No. You choose which one makes sense to you. Right? That's all it is. So Bhagavad Gita is that spiritual book. So Prabhupada's saying, if you're going to understand it, if you're going to learn it, you have to have faith, at least theoretically, that Krishna spoke this, that Krishna exists, that he is God, he did teach this, this is handed down what he taught, and it's true, it works. Even if you don't believe it, Prabhupada's saying, at least you have to enter with a theoretical understanding. And theoretical, in this case, means accept it for now. Right? One and one is two. I don't accept that. I'm not going to accept that. And the teacher says, if you don't, I can't teach you math. I can't teach you algebra. I can't teach you geometry, trigonometry, calculus. You have to accept 1 + 1 = 2. If you don't, it's not going to work. Right? Did you have any problem in school except 1 and 1 is 2? I don't accept that. No. You say, okay. Because you understand, if you're going to learn math, you have to deal with the basic premise. So that's what Prabhupada's saying. You have, okay. Just theoretically, you may not know 1 and 1 is 2, it's going to help you understand math, but you have to accept it, theoretically. Because then we can work and teach you. So that's the idea here. Accept it and see if it works. That's what Prabhupada's saying. Accept it, be open to it, see if it works. And then if it doesn't work, that's fine. You have something better, that's fine. But if you're going to be able to experience it, you have to accept it, at least in theory, so you can apply it. That's what Prabhupada's saying. So you have any questions or comments? Very difficult to understand the Bhagavad Gita because it's a great mystery. But if you're transcendental, not a mystery. Yes, sir. They don't want it. Yeah, well, yeah, that's there. yeah. Well, they don't want spirituality, but they're not necessarily willing to admit that. So the way they work around it is through philosophy and science. To prove there's no God, then they don't have to excuse themselves. They don't have to deal with the fact that they don't want to believe in God. They'll just present some idea which in their mind proves God doesn't exist, and they'll say, well, that's why I don't believe. Not that I don't want to believe, there's just no evidence. All right. There's also no evidence not to believe, but that's not necessarily understood. Yeah, my response to that is, God could exist, he could not exist. So you have two choices. Follow the logic that he does exist and try to understand that logic, or follow the logic that he doesn't exist and try to understand that logic. However it is, through physics, science, philosophy, any way you can follow the logic, one way or the other. So if someone doesn't believe, my question to them is, why did you choose that, and why did you choose to try to prove that he doesn't exist over trying to prove that he does exist? Because there's ample evidence. If you want evidence, you could say, for the sake of discussion, there's ample evidence on either side of the argument, right? So why did you decide to choose that side of the argument and then find the resources to back up that theory as opposed to this side of the argument? I think that's the important question. Because the argument covers it. It's a smokescreen. But the real point is, you decided to take this view and then find out all the information that so-called supports it. Why did you do that? Why didn't you take the other point of view? Why did you choose to take the non-God idea instead of the God idea? That's the question I ask them. I don't know if they've ever thought about it. They can't say anything because all they can do is go back to their argument. And I say, no, that's your argument for the proof of God. Why did you decide? I try to say that if you're predisposed to a certain viewpoint because of your own nature, then these things will make sense to you. Well, they won't make sense. But sometimes when Prabhupada would speak with such people, he wouldn't try to prove them wrong. He would just say, this is your faith because you don't have proof. So don't don't say it's our faith because we don't have proof. Acknowledge that it's your faith also because you don't have proof. There's no God. The universe came by accident. Where's the proof? Show me the proof. You don't have any. Now we have all these theories, and yeah, they're quite complicated. They look pretty good, but it doesn't prove that there's no God. So Prabhupada would make that point, not to push Bhagavad Gita on them, but to make the point that don't think this is not that you are free from faith and we have faith and you have science. Don't think that way, because it's not true. You don't have the science. You have the faith. You weren't there, and you can't demonstrate how it happened. So sometimes he would choose those arguments, or he would say, we have faith in Bhagavad Gita, you have faith in Lenin or Marx. Faith is the common factor. We have faith in a different leader. So now let's look at who's a better leader, Krishna or Marx. That was Prabhupada's logic. Yes?
You explained that the desire for happiness is the source of unhappiness. So isn't, I'm a little bit doubtful that because the Atma is itself Anandamaya, so isn't it like within our very nature to seek happiness?
It's a good question. He's saying that because the soul is Ananda, it's our nature to seek happiness. And I was saying the cause of unhappiness is our desire to seek happiness. A lot of times Prabhupada or sometimes would say the goal of life is to be happy. And that's true. But we're not seeking Ananda. We're seeking happiness in one of the three modes of nature. So you could say it's a perverted reflection because we're Ananda. But because of the nature of the happiness we're seeking, it's material and self-centered. So then it becomes, then it's taking us away from our Ananda. Whereas if you lose the desire to be happy and serve, then you experience your Ananda. So you can't experience it with the desire to be materially happy, you can't experience it. So yeah, we can say there's a deep-rooted desire to be happy, but because we're pursuing it materially, we can't be happy because it covers up the Ananda.
Can you please relate it with the chanting of the holy names and how we can be happy chanting the holy names in that sense?
I'll tell you a story. I started chanting in 1969 in Berkeley, California, which is in Northern California. And that was during a time when my generation was experimenting heavily with psychedelic drugs to get high. So a lot of people, when we would chant, we thought, well, if we could get high with chanting, it's better than drugs, it's less damaging, it's cheaper, it lasts longer, it's an alternative. It sounds like a better alternative, actually. Like, it would last longer. It's cleaner, it's healthier, it seemed like a better high. Or some people would think we can take drugs and chant and get even higher. So the point was get high, chant and get high. And many people joined this movement because the chanting made them high and it made them happy, and that's why they joined, right? Myself being one of them. So after I joined the movement and started hearing lectures, the lecturers would always say, you shouldn't chant to be happy. You should chant to make Krishna happy. So it was kind of like shifting my, trying to redirect me. That, well, you came for the wrong reason. You got happiness by chanting, but your motive was wrong. Because your motive should be to give Krishna pleasure. So every day I would hear this, for Krishna, Krishna. But I was, my momentum was, I like to chant, it makes me happy. And so one day I said, okay, today, when I chant, I'm just going to chant for Krishna's pleasure. And that was the first day that I was really happy chanting. The day that I completely dropped the desire for this chanting to make me happy was the happiest day of my chanting life. Right? I think we can all relate to that. We all have that experience. So that it's the trap. It's the paradox. Stop trying to be happy and make others happy and you become happy. That's a paradox. You have that experience? You make others happy, you become happy? Yeah. the material consciousness is make others happy, then now you'll become envious of them because they're happier than you. You know, one of the problems in the business world is that a lot of leaders don't want to help. They don't want to help the people under them too much because they might end up becoming more successful than they are. So that's the higher paradigm is that's perfect. Make them more successful. That's good. Will you be happy when someone becomes more successful than you? Yes, Krishna Kirtan.
Basically that we can understand Bhagavad Gita by mercy. When we get Krishna's mercy, then
yes,
we can understand. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there are some verses that say we should use our intelligence to understand Krishna.
Yes.
So
I was saying you'll understand Krishna by his mercy, and Chaitanya Charitamrita says you'll use your intelligence to understand Krishna. Prabhupada said something which I found quite interesting. He said, if you chant Hare Krishna, you'll become free from sin, but it's not that you have to do anything. It's the holy name will free you from the sin. You just have to chant it, but you don't have to like tweak the holy name, you know, turn buttons on it. They'll say, I want to make sure this holy name frees me from sin. So, you know, what do I do to this holy name that I'm chanting? You know, do I decorate it? Do I, you know, stand on my head? How do I chant that holy name that frees me from sin? No, you don't do anything. You just chant it sincerely. The holy name will do it. The same way, if you get love of Krishna, how do you get it? It's the holy name. It's a gift of the holy name. But how did you get it? You chanted the holy name, you made an effort, right? You had to do something so that the holy name could purify you. But it's not you purifying yourself, it's the holy name, but it's you chanting. I'm chanting, I'm purifying myself. Yes and no. You're chanting, the holy name is purifying you, but you're making the effort. So you're allowing the holy name to purify you. So it's the same, you're making an effort to understand Krishna with your intelligence, right? And then Dadami Buddha Yogam Tam, or Krishna gives, right? Gives or takes away. So we're making an effort. I'm trying to understand Krishna with my intelligence. And that's more of a logical understanding. Like, you know, be logical. Understand God logically. But to understand Krishna Leela, that's going to require more. Right? So that's going to require... So we're making the effort, trying to understand, and then Krishna's reciprocating with that effort. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said, you only get mercy through effort. It sounds like a paradox, doesn't it? And what did he mean by that? He said, well, Krishna's ready to give mercy to everyone, but he has to know who wants it. Then how's he going to know who wants it unless you make an effort to get it? But you can't demand it. You can't force Krishna. Krishna, I chanted 64 rounds today. Where's the mercy? I want 2 pounds of mercy. You know, but there's no. It doesn't work that way. I chanted 64 rounds every day for the last year. I want prema. I deserve it. That's in Krishna's hand, right? He gives it when he gives it. So intelligence comes from Krishna in reciprocation to your effort to try to understand him. So you're. You know, you ever heard that statement Prabhupada said, the scientist is trying to understand something, trying, he's trying to understand, he can't understand. And one day, bingo, he gets the understanding. And Prabhupada said, because he's trying, Krishna says, okay. You know, one day Krishna says, okay, stop trying, I'll just give you the understanding. So the understanding came, it's mercy. But the effort. Have you ever, like, not understood something in Krishna consciousness? For like 25 years, and one day you wake up and go, bing! I finally understood that. I never understood that. What happened? You're trying, you're sincere, and one day Krishna says, okay, I'm going to let you understand this. And often Krishna will only let you understand what you're capable of understanding. So why don't I understand more? Because if I gave you more understanding, you'd probably misuse it. Or you'd think you're smarter than everybody or better. Hey, look, you want to hear my realization? Isn't that cool? You have any realizations like that? I doubt it. Isn't it? This my realizations are deep. So Krishna's giving you all these deep realizations, but if you're immature, it'll just make you proud. So he'll give you a little bit. Isn't it? Prabhupada said that once, amazingly. He said that we all pray for God's mercy, but we all can't, we're not necessarily ready to handle all the mercy. Isn't that interesting? Like, how much can you lift up? Right? If Krishna gives you too much mercy, it's like you become, Prabhupada said, we become proud. People would say, oh Prabhu, you're so Krishna conscious. Why would they say that? Because we got mercy and they can see it. And they're saying, oh, you're so Krishna conscious. And then what happens? We become proud. So he's saying, you can't handle the mercy. So he gives you what you can handle. You ever chant some really good rounds? And at the end of those good rounds, you totally destroy your rounds by thinking, wow, I wonder if anybody chanted rounds as good as I did today. And just like, it's all ruined, right? So you got some mercy and you couldn't handle it. It made you proud. Isn't that interesting? Got some mercy and I couldn't handle it. Oh, yes. I have just written a book and we brought some here. It's my first book. It's a fantastic book. It's like, how do you, you know, you're a devotee and you're like, you're supposed to be humble. So what are you going to say? This book is fantastic. You can't say that. You know, it's just like, it's not appropriate. It's like, you know, I'll say, I'm trying to be humble. I have a book. It's a terrible book. You probably don't want to read it, you know. But if you do, you can get it when you leave. Yeah. Is that what I'm supposed to do? No. I think you'll like this book. That's interesting. If you like anything I talk about in this class or others, you'll like this. Yes? You had a question? Oh, yes, yes.
So what is faith and what is sometimes...
This what is what?
What is faith and what's...
Oh, yeah. He's asking the difference between faith and belief. It depends who's using the word and how it's being used. Sanskrit for faith is Shraddha. It means putting your heart into something. So essentially it means that you trust that if you follow a certain process, you'll get the promised result. That's the meaning of faith. There's God, there's Krishna, you are spirit soul. If you follow this process, you will connect with him, you will get love, you will be blissful, you'll live forever eternally happy. How do you know that's true? You have faith that if I do what the scriptures say, what the acharyas say, what the gurus say, I will achieve this result. That's the meaning of spiritual faith. Now, do you believe that? So maybe you grew up in a family of atheists. You don't believe that. Well, I believe you just have to do it yourself. You don't need God and so forth. So beliefs, as they're used in the modern world, are more of a psychological device, a subconscious programming. Like, what's your subconscious programming? Spiritual faith is that here is what the scripture says, and I either accept it or I don't. And the more I accept it, the more I can follow it. If I lack faith, I lack enthusiasm and inspiration to follow it. How could you do something if you don't have faith that it's going to work? So, therefore, it is said, it's like Prabhupada saying, be theoretical. He said, at least you need some little faith that possibly it could work. You have to try it, and then you'll see it working. you'll feel happy, you'll start to become more interested in the spiritual, less interested in the material. You'll see some of your problems going away, some of the contamination in your heart going away. Your faith will get stronger. But initially you need some faith that at least it could work, that what these great devotees are saying, great acharyas are saying, is true. Another point that Prabhupada makes is when people are doubting, he said, but look at all the great acharyas, spiritual masters, who accept this, not only thousands of years ago, but in the last 500 years. People who are far more intelligent than we are. Well, I don't know if I believe this. Yeah. Jiva Goswami, you know, he's like 5,000 times smarter than any of us put together. Right? And he's teaching this. And, oh, I don't know, maybe. No, we have to look at the caliber of people who accept this is phenomenal. Their character, their intelligence, their spiritual level is far beyond what any of us could ever hope to achieve. And they, you know, so we have to look at that. And then we have to look at things which go against this. What is the caliber of the people who are proponents of those ideas? What is their character? What is their understanding of the world and the universe? And so, you know, sometimes faith is reasonable. It just makes sense to have faith in this. It's answering my questions. It's backed up by hundreds and hundreds of teachings for thousands of years. It's working for millions of people. So I have, okay, that makes sense. So sometimes faith needs to be logical. Now, belief might be, okay, I have faith, but I don't believe it's going to work for me because I'm a bad person, something like that. So that belief is more of a psychological device that would prevent you from going forward in the practice because you believe that you're not capable, qualified, unworthy, or whatever. Does that make sense? Could be a personal problem. Yeah. What? Somebody else?
Yes.
Yes.
What's the baseline to apply spirituality or Bhagavad Gita in everyday life?
The baseline is that everything that Krishna teaches is applicable 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's how we should understand it. It's like what Krishna is teaching. He's teaching not physical laws, but spiritual laws. Like we could say, how often is gravity applicable? You say, well, it's always applicable. You know, it doesn't shut down. You know, so. If you look at everything Krishna teaches, you'll see it relates. At least you have to try to see how it relates to everything in your life. For example, Krishna says, "We're not the body; we're spirit soul." And okay, what does that mean? That means 24 hours a day, I should act that way, and I should see other people and relate to them as spiritual beings. So as soon as I show some prejudice towards someone, I'm not following that teaching anymore. Right? As soon as I put more emphasis on my material side of life than my spiritual, and forget my spiritual, then I've lost that teaching. So it's a principle which is to be practiced. Be kind, be compassionate, 24 hours a day. A lot of what Krishna teaches is he's teaching about how to act and how to think. How to always act and how to always think. You know. So if you look at the teachings that way, you'll understand that they're just ways of being, ways of thinking. They're not religious in the sense of ritualistic for, you know, 1 hour a day. But it's a consciousness that you're meant to carry with you. And a way you see things, a way you relate to people, a way you understand the world. So it's up to us to figure out how to interweave that within our life, right? How do we? You know, there's a lot of talk in the world today about treating people impersonally, treating them as machines and exploiting them. You know, especially in the business world, you know, we're just exploiting our employees. And so if I were to follow Bhagavad Gita, I would never do that. I would respect everyone because that's the teaching of Bhagavad Gita. Respect all forms of life. Why would I respect you? Because I see God in your heart. Krishna says, I'm in everyone's heart. Okay, now 24/7, see Krishna in everyone's heart and treat people with that kind of respect. It's just a question of how to take a philosophical idea and put it into practice, practically. That's the challenge. That's where a lot of people, they don't connect the dots. They have philosophy, but they don't see. Well, how would that apply? So you have to be able to kind of connect it all. It may take time also. But one thing that I find, I'll just tell you personally, we learn about being patient, we learn about being tolerant, that's a theme. Krishna told Arjuna, be tolerant, right? So we need tolerance all the time, right? All the time, we need to practice tolerance. It's because this world, it shakes us up. Krishna said, be equipoised, don't be disturbed by distress, don't be happy and when something good happens and then distressed when something bad happens. We're all faced with that all the time, isn't it? Something good, oh, I'm so happy, something bad, now I'm so depressed. So Krishna's saying, don't be like a yo-yo, you know, be equipoised. So something good happens, okay. Something bad happens, okay. Success or failure, just do your dharma, do your duty. Whether you're success or failure, just do your duty. So those teachings are, that's the way life is, right? It's up and down, and be equipoised. Be clean, be honest, be a friend to everyone. Wow, be a friend to everyone. We have a chance to do that every moment of the day, isn't it? And it's hard, right? The people we're supposed to love the most are the hardest to love. You know, so if we're a friend to everyone, and then Krishna says, don't put anyone in anxiety. I think, how many people have we put in anxiety? You know, it's usually the people we live with, isn't it? So, you know, I find the biggest challenge is to apply the Bhagavad Gita in situations where it doesn't seem like you could apply it. Like in a work environment, apparently it seems difficult, or at home sometimes it seems difficult. But when you think about it, it's not difficult. You can apply it. You just have to think, okay, one who puts no one in anxiety. Have you ever put your husband or wife or father or mother or son or daughter in anxiety? Of course. Right? So if I'm to follow Bhagavad Gita, I would never put them in anxiety. I would never put anyone in anxiety. Have you ever got mad when somebody cuts you off? Of course. Yell at them, honk at them. Yeah, we're putting people in anxiety all the time. So just, you know, these few teachings, what to speak of everything, you could see how they're necessary to carry with you every situation. Right? So you just have to, you have to think more about it. And you have to think of the Bhagavad Gita was spoken as a way of being and a way of acting in every situation, not just in a spiritual environment. Spiritual practice we chant, we do it in the morning. Then the practice is interacting with people all day. It's a spiritual practice. How am I going to respond to everyone in every situation? Right? And, you know, if you're with some challenging people, that's your spiritual practice, to be tolerant, right? It's easy not to be tolerant and make an excuse. Well, these people, they're just impossible, so, you know, I'm not tolerant. That's easy. But to actually be tolerant, that's a challenge. And there's plenty to tolerate, so. Does that make sense? Yeah, I could speak about that topic a lot. I mean, I've spoken actually about that for hours before. But it requires some meditation and looking at the teachings of Krishna and saying, how can I, in my life, would this apply? And as you think that way, Krishna will show you. You know, every time you get angry, every time you get upset, every time you become intolerant, think, I'm not following Bhagavad Gita now. Every time I lose control, I'm not following Bhagavad Gita. Even every time I eat a little too much, I'm not following Bhagavad Gita. Because Krishna says, don't eat too much. Don't eat too little, don't eat too much, control your senses, you know. So, right? Yes, Vrindavani.
Guru Maharaj, I wanted to know something. If you do 16 rounds, you know, you become happy, you have one job well done. Is that bad?
No, it's very good. That's spiritual happiness.
And like, when we do, sometimes the rounds are good, sometimes they're not so good. When it's not good, the whole day goes like miserable. I'm not done.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, all this is...
Bad rounds? Yeah, bad rounds are bad.
If I do good rounds, I become proud of it. I mean,
will you become proud? There's two kinds of proud. You can be proud of yourself that I've done good, but not proud that I'm better than others. You understand?
I don't feel that, but I become happy.
Yeah,
I've done good rounds today.
Yeah, that's good. But you can even be proud of that, as long as you don't feel you're better. Proud of yourself. I've done good. I'm happy with myself. I made an effort. And I've chanted nicely, and I feel... yeah.
That's not bad.
No. Give yourself a pat on the back.
Okay.
I made an effort, I chanted good rounds. But as soon as I think I'm better than others, that means I'm worse than others. That's the danger. If I do something nice, I do something well, and then I think I'm better than others, it totally destroys, you know, it totally destroys the, like, sanctity of it, the purity of it. That's the danger. But I'm proud of myself in the sense that I've tried hard. You know, I made an intention to chant well. I did it. I kept my vow. I feel good. But I don't feel better than others. In fact, if I'm advancing, I feel that it's just Krishna's mercy I could do this because I'm nothing. Without his mercy, I couldn't do it. Well, that's how I feel. Prabhupada felt that way all the time. In spite of Prabhupada's success, he never felt I'm a success. He felt Guru Maharaj is mercy. That's it. So if you chant good rounds, you can thank Krishna for the mercy. Thank you, Krishna. And stay humble. And if you stay humble, you'll be happy. Stay humble, stay happy. Happy in Krishna consciousness. That's fine. We should all be happy in Krishna consciousness. Spiritual life. That's good. But we'll be happy because we're not trying to be happy. That's the point. If you're trying to be happy in Krishna consciousness, then you're going to always be worried about whether I'm happy or not. I mean, you know, of course we should be happy. But we should just know the formula for happiness is to give up the desire to be happy and make Krishna happy. Is that okay? So, we're going to a kirtan now, so I have to leave. So thank you for coming. And we're going to Govardhan tomorrow if anyone wants to come. Just tell Nirmal Chandra in the back. He's by the book table. If you want to come, we're going to do Govardhan Parikrama. You're all invited. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Guru Maharaj ki
jai. Go Premanandi Hari Hari Bol.
Let's give a nice clap. Hare Krishna.